Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Peter Finlayson. How are you, Peter?
I'm in good shape, thank you. Excellent, Chris.
Excellent. Yeah. You're the winemaker at Bouchard Finlayson.
That's correct, yes.
And we're going to talk a wee bit about physiological ripeness, which is one of my pet topics at the moment.
Yes, physiological ripeness is different for every region in the world, but for us, we are adapted to our conditions, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's touch on a couple of your wines. Mm-hmm. I tried a range of wines yesterday, so I'm just having a look at what we tried. And I think for me, the one that I liked the most were your Chardonnays. A lot of, like New Zealand, everybody knows New Zealand, says the best white wines coming out of New Zealand are Chardonnay, but everybody just drinks Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
And South Africa has quite a good reputation for Chardonnay, but most people think of South Africa's Chenin Blanc. You didn't seem to have a Chenin Blanc here today.
No. The Chenin Blanc is a great variety. At one stage, it was 35% of all wine produced in South Africa, or vineyards planted. So it's been highly successful. And the reason, largely because it did not suffer the disease sensitivities that Chardonnay would have been prone to historically.
Was that mildews or?
No, more leaf roll virus.
Leaf roll.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
So the Chenin Blanc was quite resistant to leaf roll.
Yeah, it was tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So historically, there's also a lot of Semillon historically in the Cape. But that, even with leaf roll virus, still performed well. Yeah.
Okay. Are the vineyards pretty much clean now? Because I know when apartheid finished, South Africa had a lot of leaf roll virus, and then there was a massive digging it out and replanting with clean material.
They've got an ongoing plant improvement scheme, and the material quality has just been on an upward curve in terms of strength. Yeah.
What do you think is the best wines out of Walker Bay? Is it the Chardonnays, Semillons, and Pinots? Is it?
Well, Chardonnay is easier. You're going to grow Chardonnay in a selection of soils.
Yeah.
Pinot Noir is more fickle, and to get the Pinot Noir right is I won't say a greater stroke of luck, or requires greater dedication. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And what's the cash crop?
The cash crop.
What's the one that makes you money? Because, you know,
well, our biggest sales are in Sauvignon Blanc.
It is.
That's 33% of bottled wine sold in South Africa is Sauvignon Blanc. So,
how much?
33%.
Third is Sauvignon Blanc.
And that's because it's friendly and it's easy. Chardonnay, I think a lot of people lose sight of the fact that Chardonnay is quite robust. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to consume as an aperitif. You need to take it seriously, because it can be heavy on the palate. Yeah,
yeah.
Depends on the style of the Chardonnay, but Chardonnay is, I think, white wine for cooler climate, cold countries. Yeah, cold consumers. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
And also, the nice thing about Sauvignon Blanc, from a cash crop point of view, is you can crop it quite high.
You can crop it high. We can have it in the bottle within 4 months. We start getting a cash return in 6 months.
Yeah, exactly.
The Chardonnay is going to show their best at three, four, 5 years.
Yep.
You really want that complexity and that nuttiness to evolve. Yeah.
And the Chardonnays that I tried, I think they were, one was barrel fermented, one was Surly, I think. They're both.
The Saint Barrique is Surly tank fermented. And that's an unwooded version, which is really good if you are enjoying lobster and shellfish. The sweetness in the lobster, whatever, goes very well with the crispness on the unwooded. And then we got these two wooded ones.
That's right.
The Crocodile's Lair, which comes from a property about 50 miles north of us. And then our own, the Mission Vale, or MVC, and that is grown in Amanus, yeah.
And The Crocodile's Lair and the Mission Vale were both barrel fermented?
That's right, yes.
Which, why go barrel fermented as opposed to stainless steel and then barrel it afterwards?
Historically, nearly all wines would have been fermented in barrel. If one goes back 100, 150 years, Burgundy, etc., that was the container. Consequently, these varieties that that come out of Burgundy, the Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, would have enjoyed a natural selection process through the accompaniment of wood, and that wood is enhancing the flavors, making them more complex. Yeah, a little bit of vanilla, a little bit of sweetness from the lignans in the oak, etc. So there's a long-standing association there. Yeah. Mm. And it's a spice. Oak is a spice.
Yeah,
as you know, in, whether it's used in fish or whiskey or whatever, it's a food complement. Yeah.
No, I suppose what I was getting to is quite often with barrel fermented wine, you can taste a barrel fermented wine. Usually, when if I get a Chardonnay in particular, and you taste it, you can go, "That's barrel fermented," because it does have you know, compared to stainless steel and then oak, you get quite a different flavor profile.
Absolutely, yeah.
How would you say the flavor profile varies for you?
Well, you're getting more nuttiness, and what's nice with the barrel-fermented wines is that they do age and enjoy that complexity and that combination. The great, stronger the wine, the less obvious the oak complement is, and the more integrated it is, and the more complex it becomes, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I noticed you obviously, we talked about the Pinot Noirs, and you've got your Gaplin Peak Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
The alcohol was at 14%, which is creeping up there for a Pinot. You know, 13 and a half is quite considered quite high.
Well, climate has a lot to do with it, but it's a toss-up between complex flavors, richness when the grapes are at 23, 24 degrees sugar versus 21 and a half, 22. The wines will probably be more metallic, less full-bodied, etc. So experience has shown us that we need to try and harvest at that point to get the strength and value in the wines.
I've been talking with my listeners over the last couple of weeks about physiological ripeness versus sugar acidity balance, and so we've been doing lots of work on that with the listeners. So as the grapes are ripening, just so I can understand that trade-off between physiological ripeness and sugar acidity balance for your Pinots.
Yes,
so you're letting the sugars get up to about enough to produce about 14% alcohol.
Yeah.
And you've got good acidity balance at that point?
Well, in a vintage like 2017, which we enjoyed in February, we had beautiful acidity balance, yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever adjust the acidity, you know, put in some tartaric acid just to kick it up a little bit?
It's a part of color extraction at the crush to add some tartaric acid, and that's that takes place in Burgundy as much as it does anywhere else in the world, yes.
So you add the tartaric acid during the crushing, and it helps extract color, does it?
Yeah, yeah.
pH gives you more color.
The lower pH gives you more, higher acidity gives you more crimson color. The as your pH increases and your acidity decreases, your wine gets more bluer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one to know.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I look at a... Because I sometimes you see Pinots, and they are very light in color.
Yes.
And you're right, sometimes you see Pinots and they are quite blue.
Yeah.
And that's an indication of the pH when they were doing the crush. Oh, that's a good one. I'll have to keep an eye out for that one. That's quite good.
Yeah, well, you know, you can drop a little bit of alkali into any red wine and it'll go blue.
Oh.
Yeah, as the pH changes, yeah.
Because the thing that gives the color to wine is anthocyanins.
Anthocyanins.
So the anthocyanins change depending on the pH.
That's right, yeah.
Because I thought wines when they were young, they were bluish, and then as they old, they went browner. Is that not a pH? Is that a pH changing?
Or no,
is
that's just the anthocyanins. That's the blue, oxygen factor, yeah.
That's the blue anthocyanins. I always think of that as the blue anthocyanin coming out as part of the...
No, that's the oxygen factor, and color is also polymerizes, otherwise it forms bigger molecules and eventually falls out. Hence you get the crust in ports and wines that haven't been stabilized.
Okay, so let's just get back to the Pinot Noir and the ripeness. So you're picking it around 14%. So is that a long hang time, or is that just a function of the climate?
No, under our conditions, we've got to be very fast, because we can actually go too high. So harvest is the moment is very critical.
Yep.
Yeah.
And do you pick on sugar or do you pick on flavor?
Pick on pH. On pH.
On pH.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so you're not worried about the sugar levels, you're watching the pH.
Well, the sugar levels mustn't get beyond a certain point.
Yeah.
But if you lose pH, then you're losing a quality factor, yeah.
Okay.
Over up, yeah.
And do you find when you pick on the pH that you're getting the right physiological ripeness, the right flavor and color ripeness?
Yeah, yeah.
How close to the bone is it? Is it very much, you know, if you're pick a little bit too early, you're really in trouble, or is it? Have you got some flexibility there?
No, you've got to pick within a 5 day or a 6 day working window. Yeah, within that week you've got to target it. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but we've got quite a few sites, so we during harvest we will move around.
Yep, and each site has its own picking time.
Yeah, but each year is different because depending on the soil moisture in your ground in the soil. Impacts on the berry size,
yep,
etc. So you've got a very dry, you get a smaller berry, and that's going to give you a better acidity. Whereas if you've got a wet year, you've got maybe a bigger berry. What's interesting is that the tartaric acid level in the grape is set, and it's not. It decreases because the berry size increases.
Oh, okay.
It's the
when it swells.
The malic acid decreases as it ripens,
but the tartaric stays the same.
Yeah.
Oh, you're very good, Peter. I like this. I'm learning lots.
So, year to year, vintages are different, and we've good winemaking skills come to the fore in the challenging years. In the pleasant years, it's not a challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're picking on acidity. You're not too worried about the sugar as long as it's within tolerance.
Yeah.
You don't worry about grape ripeness, physiological ripeness, because the grapes are probably physiological.
Oh, they're physical. Right? Yeah, sure.
So, could you have, if you were picking on physiological ripeness, color and flavor?
Yes.
Could you have picked earlier? Are you well clear of the?
Well, with Pinot Noir, for instance, we have a subjective measurement that when the bunch is still hard, got that feeling of an apple, not ready yet.
Yep.
So you want to get a bit of pliability in the grapes. Look at the stem. The stem's browning, pliable in the grapes, and you just know through experience.
Yep.
And look what you're looking at, the pH factor, etc. So all those come hand in hand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Because ripening may not be even on the vines as well. So you tell your pickers not to take anything that's feeling like a hard an apple. The word Pinot comes from pine cone.
Yep.
So that shape of the bunch is a fairly small bunch, weighing about 70 to 80 grams, and if it's still green, it's firm. Yeah.
Yep. Mm. Okay. All right. No, that's cool. Now you've got some other grape varieties you're growing in Walker Bay. You've got a wine called Hannibal, which I presume is a play on the guy who went over the Alps to take on Italy.
Yes. Well, the synergy there is with the African elephant. So
that's right.
Our relationship is with the African elephant, blending together Pinot Noir and Sangiovese and some Nebbiolo. So you've got northern France and northern Italy coming together through the conqueror Hannibal. And it's an attack on the Romans because the wine is Italian style. And it's fairly unique because of the ingredients. In Italy, you're not going to see Nebbiolo, Sangiovese, Pinot Noir blended. In a hurry, no. It's like mixing religions, yes.
Or worse. But how do the things like Nebbiolo grow? Because Nebbiolo is it's a pretty high-powered grape variety, or considered to be. You don't see Nebbiolo blended very often. You don't see Pinot Noir blended very often either.
No.
To blend those two is
just
a bit crazy, really.
Well, it depends how you look upon it. I mean, it's a symphony of flavors, single varietal wines is going to show the breed, but when you start blending, you got more options.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I mean, a lot of the great wines of the world are blended. Bordeaux, up to five varieties, Chardonnay, Rhone Valley, whatever,
But how does Nebbiolo and... Because I can see how Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and etc. grow, but I always think of Nebbiolo as being quite a
it's a difficult grape,
hot climate grape. Yeah, not hot but warm, or usually they give it a long growing season, don't they?
I think the long growing season would be better. We struggle a little bit with it because it's very sensitive to sun damage.
Sunburn.
Yeah. Yep. So it doesn't like wind. So there are years when our crop is limited. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's such a wonderful blending factor because it's got these beautiful, strong structured tannins, which are just so gratifying.
Is it? There doesn't appear to be much Italian grape varieties in South Africa.
No, no.
Is it quite unusual for you to be growing three?
I imported the Sangiovese and Nebbiolo into South Africa in 1989. Mm-hmm. And this follows my period in Germany in 1975 when I tasted some fantastic Barolos and some Brunellos. And I never forgot the impact of those. But we had a situation in South Africa where you could not... we imported vine stocks. You had to wait 10 years to go through a quarantine situation. That changed in 1987, and that law changed to 2-year quarantine. So I immediately applied for the Sangiovese and Pinot and Nebbiolo just to do some research and see how they were going to fit into our quality spectrum.
Yep.
And also understanding that European countries, particularly Germany, Italy, whatever, were enjoying wines of the taste spectrum which they are familiar with. Mm-hmm. South Africa at that stage was producing a lot of red wine which was blended with Cabernet Sauvignon Cinsault, which was a sort of traditional Cape red blend. And it wasn't necessarily the taste profile for folks in the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah, so when I traveled back from Germany in 1975 after my spell at Geisenheim, I was on the last voyage of a cruise liner called the Europa, Italian boat, and the maitre d', or the sommelier in the dining room, knew that I was a winemaker, and he also knew this was the end of the line for this particular ship, and he didn't give a continental about his wine cellar anymore, so he just kept on feeding me with these magnificent examples of Italian wines, which at the time I regret I didn't make notes on, but the names to me were unpronounceable or whatever. But it just left such a mark on the quality of these superb wines, and I just realized that there was a place to go with these varieties, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you import, you got them into South Africa.
Yes.
Has anybody ever, any other people picked up the grape varieties in other regions?
Yeah, sure. There's some Nebbiolo is pure varietal from Steenberg and a couple of others. Sangiovese is grown also on a limited scale. But
yep.
Sangiovese is much easier than Nebbiolo. Yeah, and Sangiovese produces some really good wines. But, but they're not consumer known in South Africa. Hence, it's for me a much easier vehicle to take them in the blend and build our own brand with Hannibal. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're going to leave it there, Peter.
All right.
Thank you very much for your time.
Chris, wonderful to chat to you.
Cheers.
Cheers.